Well, everybody likes a good story, and spiritualism is full of them. Unfortunately, today you'll have the opportunity to hear some of these stories if you stay for the class on the history of spiritualism. Spiritualism has been around now for almost exactly 168 years. Let's see, 168 years and 3 days. One class can't cover everything that's come to pass in that time, but it will give you an excellent overview. The interesting thing about true stories is that there's always more to find out. Have you ever been gripped by a documentary or a biography or an historical thriller to the extent that you found yourself afterwards Googling certain details to resolve the unanswered questions in your mind? Well, that's what I want to do with you today. Share a few details about the stories behind the story of spiritualism. Give you some intriguing tidbits about a few of the people who played their part in making it all happen. I brought with me my copy of The History of Spiritualism by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. It's a very thick book, and I left it on the counter in the back. That's all right. It was written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, same Conan Doyle who wrote the Sherlock Holmes stories, that same Conan Doyle who was a medical doctor and a war correspondent and a campaigner for social justice. And what you may not realize is that in the last quarter of his life, he abandoned his literary career and devoted himself to spreading the spiritualist message throughout the world. He lectured on spiritualism in Great Britain, Australia, South Africa, and the United States. He covered 55,000 miles at a time when travel was pretty slow and addressed a quarter of a million people. In 1926, he published The History of Spiritualism in two volumes at his own expense. Arthur Conan Doyle was a spiritualist. He saw a need. He had the skills, and so he took it upon himself to document, excuse me, the history of spiritualism. His well-researched facts give us fascinating insights into those times and clear up more than a few misconceptions, myths, and outright untruths that circulated in those days. He was there. When I say he was there, I mean that he knew many of the principal actors in the early years of spiritualism. He wasn't actually at the Fox Cottage in Hinesville on the night of March 31st, 1848. He wasn't born until about 10 years later. But he knew those who had been there and was able to get firsthand stories of what happened. He did the research, read the depositions, and created a cohesive and accurate story. This talk will touch on, but not be too much of a spoiler, I hope, for the topics to be covered in today's class. It will, I hope, interest you, though, in looking deeper into the story of how spiritualism came to be. So first, for some background, here's the 60-second version of the story of Hinesville. And most of you are familiar. The young sisters, Katie and Margaret Fox, who lived with their family in a creepy old farmhouse with a lot of noises in the night. The wrappings in the house to which they applied an alphabetic code and brought the meaning of the messages from a murdered peddler to light. The interest in spirit communication that expanded exponentially from that event. Almost immediately, skeptics claimed that the sisters had caused the wrappings themselves, that it was all a trick. Skeptics abound, some honest, and some pursuing a personal agenda of being clever enough to prove that everything is a hoax. And as we know all too well from the manipulation of the media in our own times, casting doubt leaves people not knowing what they can believe. As always, Conan Doyle did his homework. He went to the source, those who had been there, and those who had access to the details. The story of the Fox sisters had many twists and turns as the years went by. Sometimes it sounded like a good mystery. Here are just a few examples of the sidebars with which Conan Doyle fleshed out the story. He captured statements from the people who lived in the cottage prior to the Fox family. The deposition of Lucretia Pulver, who heard someone walking through the house when she had lived there in 1844. I could read it all to you, but we'd be here for many hours, so I'm just going to tell you when it was. The deposition of Mrs. Hannah Weekman, who lived there in 1846 and 1847. She gave a lengthy description of the knocking and the sounds of walking that she and her husband had tried unsuccessfully to investigate. One night, her 8-year-old daughter began screaming in the middle of the night. She said that, quote, something had been moving about over her head and face, but it was cold, and she did not know what it was. She said that she felt it all over her, but she was most alarmed at feeling it on her face. She was very much frightened. We got the statement of Michael Weekman, her husband. When he heard rapping, he went to the door. No one was there. He went back to bed, but heard the rapping again. He opened the door quickly, but again, no one was there. The third time, he stepped outside, angry that someone was, quote, making game of me. Eventually, he began to try to catch the culprit. He went to the door and held the latch, waiting. And in a minute or two, the rapping began again. Quote, my hand was on the door, and the knocking appeared to be on the door. I could feel it jar with the raps. Again, no one was there. Now, the following year, 1848, Mr. and Mrs. Fox found themselves more and more disturbed by the knocking. They tried to ignore it. Yet beginning in March, it continually increased in intensity. The children refused to sleep in any room but with their parents. They also tried to catch the perpetrator. The husband would wait on one side of the door and the wife on the other. But the rappings continued and seemed to be coming from within the door. As the phenomena became more and more interesting on the night of March 31st, neighbors were called in to witness it. Conan Doyle gathered up the statements of neighbors who were in the cottage that night, even late into the night after the children and their mother had been taken to a neighbor's house to get some sleep. These neighbors continued to hear the rappings in their absence, exactly as before. And the rappings were not faint. One neighbor said, quote, I felt the bedstead jar when the sounds were produced. Excuse me. Conan Doyle printed the newspaper story that appeared many years later, documenting finding the skeleton of the peddler in the cellar. It gave a lot of the details, and you can read it in his book, but I'll just read one sentence. The Boston Journal, November 23rd, 1904. Quote, the skeleton of the man supposed to have caused the rappings first heard by the Fox sisters in 1848 has been found in the walls of the house occupied by the sisters and clears them from the only shadow of doubt held concerning their sincerity in the discovery of spirit communication. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle showed us that with spiritualism, you can dig and dig, no pun intended, and still never get to the end of the story. So let's take a look at another less well-known story. Most of you probably have no idea of who Sir Oliver Lodge was. I noticed that Conan Doyle dedicated the book to him and wondered, why him? Why him? Taking my cue from Arthur Conan Doyle, I found that one question leads to another, and so I began to dig. Sir Oliver Lodge was a rather famous man of science. Now, lest you think that those who investigated and experimented with spiritualist phenomena were a bunch of amateurs. Let me tell you that he was a professor of physics and mathematics at the University College Liverpool. He was a physicist involved in the development of and holder of key patents for radio. End quote. He identified electromagnetic radiation independent of Hertz's proof, whatever that means. In other words, though, he was no slouch, scientifically speaking. His interest in psychic phenomena led him to study it, mainly telepathy, in the late 1880s. He was a member of the Ghost Club. Well, that made me curious, so I Googled it. It's for real, and it's still in existence. The Ghost Club is a paranormal investigation and research organization founded in 1862 that investigates ghosts and hauntings. It's widely believed to be the oldest such organization in the world. Sir Oliver's first experience in psychical research dates back to 1883, and his most notable observations in physical mediumship were made with the famous Italian medium, Eusebia Palladino. Oh, there's a story. She was an interesting and difficult case in that she cheated sometimes. And it seemed to make no difference to her that she might be exposed in these activities, as she repeatedly was. Given the slightest opportunity, Eusebia cheated. At the same time, there were also manifestations that occurred that could not be explained. Over the years, Eusebia continued to challenge and baffle the scientists and the investigators, of which there were many. Some of the phenomena she produced included levitation of tables, musical instruments, and even herself. Chairs moved around the room, curtains blew. In a visit to America late in her life, she was detected in some obvious tricks that offended her sitters so much that they rejected her as a fake. But Howard Thurston, the famous conjurer, decided to disregard these things and continue the sitting. Just as another well-known sitter was reproaching her for moving some object with her hand, another object, quite out of her reach, moved across the table. This is the kind of thing that kept it very interesting and very difficult and very frustrating for the investigators, trying to sort out the genuine phenomena from the trick. The Minerva Scientific Circle calculated about 75% of what occurred during the sittings was genuinely paranormal. At one point, late in her career, she was investigated by a three-man committee with very formidable credentials, including a former magician who had an excellent record of exposing fraud. Yet they concluded, quote, "It was only through constant repetition of the same phenomena in a good light and at moments when its occurrence was expected, but they found that all their precautions failed to prevent the phenomena," end quote. "We gradually reached the conviction that some force was in play which was beyond the reach of ordinary control and beyond the skill of the most skillful conjurer." Her case is certainly a peculiar one. It may be truthfully said that no medium has ever more certainly been proved to have psychic powers, and no medium was ever more certain to cheat upon occasion. In the field of mental mediumship, Sir Oliver Lodge spent a great deal of time investigating Boston's famous medium, Mrs. Lenore Piper. In 1889, he invited her to England for tests. Now, he was an exacting researcher and took every conceivable precaution to eliminate any possibility of foreknowledge or fraud on Mrs. Piper's part. He went so far as to temporarily dismiss all of his servants and replace them with others who knew absolutely nothing about any member of his family or of Piper herself. She lived as a guest in the lodge home, but was kept incommunicado and was constantly watched by experienced professional detectives. With Piper's permission, private mail was opened and read. Every possibility of her communicating with others and receiving any type of information was completely eliminated. Yet Piper's spirit guides provided accurate communication in every test that Lodge devised, which helped convince him that the spirit phenomena were real. Besides his many experiments, his personal experiences convinced him of the continuity of life and the truth of spirit communication. He never became a spiritualist, actually, though he fully embraced the philosophy. He remained a Christian his entire life. World War I, though, had shifted his focus. His son Raymond was killed in the war. Sir Oliver visited several mediums and wrote about the experience in a number of books, including Raymond, or Life and Death, which was the bestseller at the time and I found is downloadable from archive.org. And it's just full of documentation of the story. It includes letters from the front that gave the sitter of some insight into Raymond when he was alive, and then documents various messages that Sir Oliver received from Raymond after he was killed, including private sittings and through automatic writing. The last section of the book, called Life and Death, was written, as he says, with the hope that it will, quote, help people in general to realize that this subject is not the bugbear which ignorance and prejudice have made it, that it belongs to a coherent system of thought full of new facts, of which consistent study is necessary, that it is subject to a law and order of its own, and that though comparatively in its infancy, it is a genuine branch of psychological science. Today, inspired by the example of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, I followed some of the questions that arose. Why was the book dedicated to Sir Oliver Lodge? What was the story of Eusebia Palladino, and why was she so controversial? Why was Sir Oliver impressed with Lenore Piper? Was she really that good? Why was Raymond, or Life and Death, such a bestseller in its time? And in the process of searching for answers, I learned a great deal. And I've shared some small part of that with you. Well, why do these stories matter enough to share with you today? As I said in the beginning, the interesting thing about truth stories is that there's always more to find out. Spiritualist philosophy encourages us to read and learn, to fill in the gaps in our knowledge, to form our own opinions, and reach our own conclusions. How can we do that if we don't try to find out the answers to the questions that puzzle us? I hope these stories today have given you a thirst for seeking out the details that allow you to make up your own mind about everything. Be like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and keep digging, because that's the spiritualist way. And I forgot to tell you why Conan Doyle dedicated the book to Sir Oliver Lodge. It turns out it's simply because they were friends, and they had both lost a son in the war.